That is the sound you never want to hear. It is the sound of the warning siren going off at a nuclear power plant. When you hear that sound, it means you are in the nuclear hot seat. Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly podcast keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevy. I'm the producer and host of Nuclear Hot Seat, and I do this show because I found myself 1 mile away from the nuclear reactor at Three Mile Island when it was malfunctioning, and I don't want any of you to ever find yourself in that same position. Today, we're going to be interviewing Cecile Pineda, who's the author of Devil's Tango, How I Learned the Fukushima Step by Step. This is a quirky, funny, extremely readable, if not enjoyable, orientation to the nuclear situation in Japan, the U.S., and elsewhere. I don't know how enjoyable nuclear information is, but she certainly made it a fascinating mix. And we'll be talking about her mosaic of facts, reporting, dreams, intuitions, and observations in a little while. Today is Tuesday, April 17, 2012, 1 year and 37 days since the Fukushima tragedy began on March 11, 2011, and here is the latest nuclear news. In Washington, after an on-site tour of what remains of the Fukushima Daiichi plant, in Washington yesterday, U.S. Senator Ron Wyden, a senior member of the U.S. Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, sent a letter to Japanese Ambassador Ikiro Fujisaki looking for ways to advance and support cleanup and recovery efforts in Japan. Wyden's principal concern is the relocation of spent fuel rods currently being stored in unsound structures immediately adjacent to the ocean. Wyden wrote in the letter, "The precarious status of Fukushima Daiichi nuclear units and the risk presented by the enormous inventory of radioactive materials and spent fuel in the event of further earthquake threats should be of concern to all and a focus of greater international support and assistance." Wyden visited Fukushima on April 6 of 2012 while on a congressional delegation trip to the region. So for the first time, we have somebody in the United States Senate speaking out on Fukushima and asking for attention and for action to be taken. We will be following that story closely. In connection with this, maybe they don't want it to seem so, but TEPCO has announced that they will start covering the number 4 spent fuel pool, the one with the fuel rods in it, on today, Tuesday, April 17th. They made their announcement yesterday on April 16th, which was the same day that the senator's announcement was made. They said that they started the preparation work for the installation of the cover for fuel removal on Unit 4 on March 23rd. So much for Japanese transparency on this story. They're starting main work on the cover today, and it looks like they're just positioning this information to try to take the sting out of Senator Wyden's letter and press release and all the attention that it has been garnering. That's okay, as long as they're taking action, and hopefully the international call for help will actually result in something. Now, in another example, not only of lack of transparency, but total numbnuts, a radiation discharge near Philadelphia was kept secret from the public for weeks. Now, several thousand gallons of water containing as much as five times the government's safe level, put safe in quotes, level of radioactive tritium, was accidentally released at Exelon Nuclear's Limerick Generating Station near Philadelphia. The water was then flushed into the Schuylkill River. Now, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, concentrations of contamination in the water were considered so low that they presented, listen to the phrase, no immediate health and safety concerns, which is why the incident was not reported publicly until 23 days after it happened. The event happened at 3 a.m. on Monday, March 19. A manhole cover overflowed during a scheduled and, again, look at the terminology, permitted radiological release. Several thousand gallons of water were discharged through the permitted discharge to Possum Hollow Creek, which flows from the plant ground into the Schuylkill River. Exelon estimated something less than 15,000 gallons, 14,998, were legally dumped into the river, which is drinking water source for several downstream communities, including Philadelphia. It is important to note that Limerick and other nuclear power plants routinely release radioactive water into the river. But the releases must be controlled and any levels of radioactivity well within allowable limits. Now, let's take a look at the wording here. These are some of the NRC's and the nuclear industry's favorite words. No immediate health concerns. That's right. Radiation takes time to accumulate in the body and create stress on the body and create the cancers. So immediate, no. Concern, yes. Permitted radiological release, meaning it's under a particular level, there is no safe level of radiation exposure. We cover this time and time again on Nuclear Hot Seat. It is based on findings of the Nobel Peace Prize winning group, Physicians for Social Responsibility. Finally, this is said by the communications manager for the Limerick Generating Station. Love this language. We made the courtesy notifications because we like to keep stakeholders and community members informed. Of course, they were only kept informed 23 days after the event. We can always trust the nuclear industry. When in doubt, they lie. In Florida, the NRC has fined Florida Power and Light for failing to report that the ventilation system for the emergency response facility at its Turkey Point nuclear power plant had been taken out of service on two occasions, at one point lasting for 7 months. Had an emergency occurred during these periods, staff working in the technical support center would not have been protected from radiological hazards that would occur in some accidents, according to the NRC. The finding was more than minor because it affected the emergency preparedness cornerstone objective of ensuring that the licensee is capable of implementing adequate measures to protect the health and safety of the public in the event of a radiological emergency. Regulations require that plant operators inform the NRC of a major loss of emergency assessment, off-site response, and off-site communications capability within 8 hours of it occurring, as opposed to 16 months, and realize that this would have been the support center for taking over control should there be an emergency. So in other words, the emergency responders in charge of our protection would have been compromised in their health by radiation. For its failure to inform the NRC, the NRC issued Florida Power and Light with a fine of $140,000, which is less than 1 hour's worth of profit from their nuclear reactors. Over in Japan, Industry Minister Yukio Edano said on April 15th that all nuclear reactors in Japan will be offline as of May 16. He's referring to this as a temporary situation. We will see how that plays out. On May 5th, the number 3 reactor at the Tomari nuclear plant in Hokkaido, the only active nuclear reactor out of the 54 in Japan, is scheduled to be shut down for regular maintenance. The central government has been trying to restart the number 3 and number 4 reactors at the Oi nuclear plant in Fukui Prefecture, but it has met local opposition in the form of thousands and thousands of residents protesting, a petition campaign, letters, email, and a general uprising of protest against the restart of the reactors. This was the first time the government acknowledged that all nuclear reactors will be shut down in Japan as of May 5th. This is the first time since 1966, when commercial reactors started operations, that Japan will be a nuclear-free country. Minister Edano said, "We will reduce dependence on nuclear power to zero on a permanent basis as soon as possible." Well, you've already taken away the nuclear power plants, so now it's just a matter of adjusting to less power and getting some of the alternatives more strongly structured online. Here's a note from our friend Mokizuki, who writes FukushimaDiary.com, and he keeps us in touch with what's happening on the ground in Japan. And his report is that 3 nursery schools in the Toyohashi city of Aichi purchased shiitake mushrooms carrying a radiational load of 1,400 becquerels per kilogram, so far over the allowable limit, it's not funny. 3.7 kilograms of the mushrooms were purchased by these 3 nursery schools, and 400 of the students and staff ate them between February and April of this year, where it was served between 10 and 50 times with udon or with rice, neither of which have been known to mitigate the effects of radiation once it has been ingested. Please note that mushrooms are a bioaccumulator of radiation and a good food to avoid. In Europe, there is a nasty fight erupting over subsidies for nuclear power plants and their construction. In the European Union, nuclear power industries are lining up to grab as much taxpayer money as they can, but ingeniously, they're not asking for money from their own taxpayers in their own countries, but the taxpayers of other countries. France, the UK, Poland, and the Czech Republic, which are all planning on building nuclear power plants, are pressuring the European Union with the goal of getting the EU to reclassify nuclear energy as a low emissions technology, which is a heavily subsidized category that includes solar and wind power. This would make nuclear power eligible for the same subsidies. In other words, take the money away from solar and wind. If the four countries succeed, the EU would subsidize not only construction of nuclear power plants, but also the sale of their electricity to the tune of billions of euros to be paid by all taxpayers in the EU via the European Union budget. Here's the irony. 20% of that budget falls upon German taxpayers. And it's Germany that decided to exit nuclear power after Fukushima. Within 3 months of the accident, it revoked the licenses of 7 of its 17 nuclear power plants and then voted to exit nuclear power altogether by 2022. Thus, efforts to get German taxpayers to subsidize nuclear power in other countries is not going to go over very well. And knowing the Germans, there will be a fight, and this fight could get nasty. Let's turn to a much more positive look right now. My guest today is Cecile Pineda, who is an established author who turned her brilliant mind to the subject of Fukushima Daiichi and all the nuclear and other issues that are connected to it. And Devil's Tango can be described as a whirlwind tour of the nuclear industry seen through the lens of the individual and planetary crisis still unfolding in Japan. As much a personal reflection as investigative journalism, Pineda's searing denunciation of the nuclear industry lays bare the connection between nuclear warfare and nuclear energy. And there's so much more to it. I just want to cut to the chase. And Cecile, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
And thank you so much for having me, Libby.
It's a pleasure. So you have been a professional writer for many years, and also you've been an activist. Could you fill us in a little bit on your background before we move over to the book?
Well, I've lived a long life, and I've had several incarnations of it. My first professional life was 12 years in experimental theater. I founded my own company, and I directed it in San Francisco for 12 years. And at the point where I stopped operating, Reagan had come to power, and money for the arts had dried up, and I saw the writing on the wall. But fortunately, or otherwise, I had begun to write something, and what I had begun to write became my first published novel. Of course, there were no guarantees that I would finish it or that it would be publishable or that, in fact, it was a novel at all. But it apparently won a lot of prizes, so I was wrong on that score. And I continued to write. I was not written out after the first novel, so I followed it almost immediately with the second novel, which is set in...
Well, let's not go into the details of that because I want to keep our focus.
Okay.
But you've published how many books now?
I've published 6 novels, and there are many others in the cheese drawer. And this is my first book of nonfiction.
Now, what moved you to write Devil's Tango?
Well, it's very simple. I was invited to write it. I had a neighbor whom I deeply respected. He was an activist all his life. He had marched with Martin Luther King. He had participated in the Mississippi Summer. And he was a man of tremendous courage and distinction. And when he was dying, he summoned me, and he said to me, "Well, you know, you care so much about the planet. I want you to write the book of life and death." And 13 days after he died, Fukushima blew. So that was the invitation, and it was very clear that that was going to be the book of life and death.
That's amazing. I wish you'd put that as your subtitle, but that might have scared some people away. So how did you come upon this particular way of writing it? Because for those listeners who've not yet encountered the book, it's a mosaic. You have lots of different pieces that come together in an overall pattern with tremendous power, but it is not like other books I've read on the nuclear industry that are very fact-based. So how did you decide to or discover this way of writing it?
No, it discovered me. First, I should confess to my darkest secret. I'm a very lazy writer. So most of my work is written in crops, that is, in short gasps, short sections. And
sprints, not marathons.
And you know, and that, yes, exactly. And that's very helpful to me. It also helps me in terms of tracking what I'm doing. And so the first thing that I did was I continued to write. I started to write and I continued to write. And at first, you know, I personally was processing what I immediately intuited was a planetary catastrophe. I mean, there was no doubt in my mind on March 11th that this was going to usher into our world a whole new paradigm. And I felt that from now on, my air, my food, everything that I lived would be, in fact, contaminated. And that is, in fact, what has occurred. But it has been occurring all along since, in fact, since atmospheric testing. So we're talking about 1955 on. There's been consistent contamination of the planet, and of course it's cumulative. It doesn't go away. So I stayed with it. In other words, it's what psychiatrists tell you. They say, stay with it, stay with it. And so gradually I tried to encounter this, what in my heart and mind is horror. I tried to process my fear and my absolute horror at what had happened. And I tried to approach it, it approached me in all different kinds of ways. So as you say, there are dream sequences, there are poems, there are George Carlin impersonations. There's a horse race with the archaea, that is to say, very primitive viruses, the next generation of life on Earth, and there's a horse race to see which one will be the next one. There's a corporate striptease. I mean, all of these things it was like a whirligig.
Mm-hmm.
And writing this book was very much having a tiger by the tail. It was very expensive. I started by wrecking my car, and I ended by breaking my ankle. So that's the result of the devil's tank.
Now, that is not required as part of the writing process.
No.
I know that for myself. Now, as you were writing this, as we read the book, is this the sequence that came up? Did you do some kind of organizing of the flow through of it? How did you end
Almost
up
not.
Structuring it?
Almost not. It's pretty much what you see there. However, between the time I had passed on the first set of galleys with thousands of corrections, there were, of course, new developments, as there are every day, as your reportage today makes clear. This is an ongoing catastrophe. And so I felt it was very important to add what I call last gasp changes. And one of those last gasp changes was a very encouraging tidbit that I read about Occupy Toledo. Occupy Toledo crossed the border into Michigan, where the NRC was holding an environmental impact report on a Fermi nuclear reactor that was proposed for the shores of Lake Michigan. And Occupy Toledo showed up. And Mike checked the entire panel and told them that, in so many words, that they would do everything in their power to make sure that this reactor never, ever was built. and they identified themselves as the 99%, and they, in fact, shouted the moderator down so much so that he tried to shout them down, and he couldn't succeed, and finally they adjourned the meeting. So I thought that was a very encouraging emblem of what the 99% needs to do now, because clearly we are encountering a government that, first of all, is a shill for corporations. It's not a government anymore. And the only strength that we have is in numbers and in mic checking. And I think that we really have to begin to envision the world that we want to create. And the way to do it is simply to take over. We have, infinitely too long, we have been passive. We have allowed these things to happen.
Well, awareness is a major part of changing things around. So in getting back to the book again, I have nothing against a good political rant. Let's try and focus back on the book. Who do you see as benefiting most greatly from your book? Who would you imagine to be your ideal reader of this book? Somebody who's familiar with it, somebody who doesn't know anything about the issues?
Yeah, because somebody pointed out to me recently that the very fact that it has so many different voices, I mean, they're extremely musical, poetic voices. They're journalistic. There's reportage. And then there's fun. There's whimsy. There are flights of fancy. And so it appeals to a much broader spectrum than, say, any one of those forms alone. I think it has the strength to draw in a lot of people that ordinarily would not be interested, perhaps, in examining this issue. So I take courage from that, because I wrote this book based on what one of the activists who's quoted in the book says. She says, "Make no mistake, those of us who have been going to jail for 40 years to try to prevent the proliferation of nuclear warheads and nuclear energy, we need help. We need other people to participate." So my hope in writing this book was that other people would join me and other people in our activism.
So what has the response been to the book so far, both in the activist community and also to the general public?
Well, it's an amazing thing. Books are flying off the shelves. This book is not difficult at all to sell, and it is reaching a wider and wider circle of people, because people are not only buying it for themselves, but they're also buying it to give to friends. So it's basically being shipped all over the country. My publisher has received orders on the website, and for your listeners who may want to purchase the book, you can do so by going to my publisher's website, and I give you that right now. It's Wings Press, WingsPress.com, Wings Press, one word, .com.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of distribution has the publisher been getting? Has there been resistance to it anywhere? Has this gone to any of the national book distributors?
Oh, first of all, my publisher is part of the IPG group. IPG Book is an international publishing group, and they are the distributors of this book. Right now, they are in London representing the foreign rights for this book, and they will be also at the Frankfurt Book Fair representing foreign rights as well. That, of course, comes in October. So I can't estimate to you if there have been resistances, because resistances are measured in silence. I can tell you this, that so far there have been no reviews of this book. But despite that fact, it's flying off the shelves. So maybe, you know, reviewers may be a thing of the past. I don't know.
Well, the entire paradigm for public, for getting books into the public's hands has changed completely because of the internet and the number of distribution channels that are out there. But since you are going through an established publisher, it's always best to find out if it's being picked up. Also, there might be a time lag. Certainly the daily papers, you released on the anniversary of Fukushima, which was March 11th, slightly over a month ago. So certainly none of the monthly publications with their lead time would have been able to get anything into print yet. So we still may be seeing those. If you were to have a dream as to where this would go and what the impact would be, not just for you but for others, what would that be?
No, this is not for me. It is for others, which is why it's very easy for me to do this work. First of all, I would like to see it translated into French and German in Europe. I would like to see it translated into Russian, into Hindi, and into Chinese, as well as Japanese in Asia, because these countries are the countries that are now going to, they're planning to put many nuclear plants online in the near future. So I would like this book to be widely read throughout the world, because I think that it makes a very strong case for where we have fundamentally gone wrong with the energy picture. And I'm particularly fond of the very short sections on solar power, because about 80 years after James Watt invented the steam engine, a French inventor named Michaud invented a solar-powered steam engine. And it seems to me that it's a point where the planet took a very, very wrong turn, because James Watt's technology had already been widely accepted in the industrialized world.
And, of course, nobody could foresee where the adoption of a certain paradigm as opposed to another was going to lead.
Well, you know, that's what's very curious about Michaud. He wrote in 1825, something like that, he wrote something to the effect that where will France be when coal runs out? Very interesting. So he did foresee it. I mean, he must have been an extraordinary man. Very little is known about him. For your listeners, I'm going to spell his name out because I think it's fascinating to read
about. Okay, and then we're going to revisit your publisher again just so they have another chance to know what the website is.
Okay. So it's Mouchot, M-O-U-C-H-O-T, and you can look him up on the Internet.
And, for again, we would like to promote the ability, the spreading of information. That's what this podcast is about. That's what so much of my writing is about, and yours as well. So, again, if people wish to purchase a copy of the book in hard format, meaning we're talking the analog world here, not the digital ebook world, where could they go to purchase a copy?
Okay, there are two possible ways. The first way to get hard copy is to go to wingspress.com. That's my publisher. He mails all over the world. But you can also go to your independent bookstore, not the chain, but the independent bookstore. You can order hardcover there, but you can also order ebooks. Now, what's very important to know is that very recently Amazon has delisted all the publications of independent publishers in the United States. So I think that we want to boycott Amazon. But if you go to www.ipgbook.com, that's International Publishers Group, ipgbook.com, you can download the Kindle version there. Or you can download a free application to enable a Kindle reader to accept EPUB files. And the EPUB files are the format used by Barnes & Noble's Nook and the reader and iPad and smartphones, etc. So it is also available in electronic form. But in order to get a download for the Kindle, you have to do an end run.
Well, this is great information. And, of course, like I said, the book is such that one can open it anywhere and read a short segment and get it. It does not have to be read sequentially. So it's something good to put up, pick up and put down. It's also something great to curl up in a corner and read, because there's a humanity about the way that you put the information forth that's very different from, say, Dr. Helen Caldicott or one of the nuclear experts who have a lot of facts, but sometimes one can be bludgeoned into submission by looking at all of that information. Whereas I believe it's the humanity of what you put into your writing that makes this book so readable, which is what makes it so powerful. So, Cecile, I wish you every success. The book's title is Devil's Tango. There's an apostrophe between the devil and the S. Devil's Tango, How I Learned the Fukushima Step-by-Step by Cecile Pineda. And, Cecile, thank you so much for being on Nuclear Hot Seat this week.
And
I welcome you to stick around for the rest of the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Terrific. So just a few news headlines keep you up on some of the stories that are happening. In India, a continued police state exists around the Kudankulam nuclear power plant, where 10,000 and more villagers have been locked into their community by police and the federal government. They are protesting the going online of the power plant. Their protests have been peaceful, but the governments have not. At the same time, it is important that they are concerned about this. In agreement is the government of Sri Lanka. Now, that country was badly hit in the 2008 tsunami in South Asia, and they have now expressed concerns about the safety of India's nuclear reactors in light of the possibility of damage from the exact same situation. In Japan, a 35-ton piece of machinery fell into the MOX fuel pool in Unit 3, not Unit 4, but Unit 3, and TEPCO claimed that there has been no damage. 35-ton piece of machinery, not a problem. Didn't even chip the plaster. Yeah. This story, the AARP has joined a lawsuit in Florida to stop nuclear fees from being charged on people's bills. This was the plan that took place to charge people for the building of a nuclear power plant before the plant was actually built, to accumulate the funds to be able to do so. But there was no guarantee that the plant would ever be built. So, in other words, it was a tax on people's utility bills that would never end and never have a result, not unlike the plan that was used in The Producers to not open a Broadway show or just barely open it but keep all the proceeds. Now, we would like to send our condolences from Nuclear Hot Seat to Ben Davis Jr. and his associate Donna Gilmore, because we have learned that though they maintained optimism until the end, that the California Nuclear Initiative to shut down the nuclear plants in California would make it to the November ballot. Unfortunately, even though there was a surge of signatures around the anniversary of Fukushima and also in response to the recent closure of San Onofre, on April 16th, they reached the end of the circulation period and fell short of the 800,000 signatures they had originally hoped for. There is still a chance through court action that this issue could be placed on the November ballot, but for now, it's off the table. To which I would like to congratulate both these individuals and everyone who worked with them. I did my little bit as well, for the work that they did in trying to get this across, and realize that 2014 is just around the cover, and this time will be organized before the announcement happens. Now, I always like to include something on holistic healing on each program so that we can mitigate the effect of radiation on our bodies. And I was going to be talking about radiation protection for your car, but I received a very interesting message from one of my regular Nuclear Hot Seat followers. She wrote, "Alert. My daughter just called me from Radford, Virginia, where she was having lunch with one of her gal pals. They had ordered tuna steak sandwiches at a restaurant called Sharky's. The server said they were out of tuna and had been for 2 weeks. There was a problem with the tuna, and their supplier would not sell it to them. My daughter asked, kind of jokingly, why? Was it radioactive? And the server said, yes, that's exactly what it is. Now, we are following up with the company. I've already spoken with Sharkey's and been referred to U.S. Foods, which is the company that provides their tuna, and looking to learn what the cause is of the holdup. I've heard things mentioned colloquially, which includes it's because of La Nina, it's because of the water temperature, it's because there aren't enough fishing boats in Japan. When I find out the real story, I'll report it to you on Nuclear Hot Seat. In the meantime, just a reminder of a report that came out in November, that cesium was found in 16 of 22 species of fish that were tested by Japan in November, which is the last full month for which data is available. And it included cesium being located in 93% of the tuna caught. Some of the fish were caught in Japanese coastal waters, and other catches were made hundreds of kilometers away in open ocean. So until we hear further, it's probably best to stay away from the ahi tuna, as well as the sushi, and really any fish that was canned, any ocean fish that was canned after March 11, 2012. We'll catch up with the protection for your car next week. And here's a final thought. Again, I was alerted to this by somebody coming on Nuclear Hot Seat on the Facebook page. Did you know that NRC Commissioner Christine L. Signicki's term ends on June 30th? At that time, she will need Senate approval for another term. She was appointed in 2008 by former President Bush and has voted against the majority of the safety points raised by the NRC's own recommended actions to be taken in response to Fukushima lessons learned. In other words, she didn't learn the lessons, and she's voted against them consistently. We, the public, we the people, can raise public awareness about this nuclear numbnuts act to get her knocked out of contention for the NRC and have a more safety-minded commissioner approved instead. Try writing a letter to your senators. We can start with not only your two U.S. senators, but also Senator Wyden in Oregon. He's a Democrat. He just came forward. He was the first story today. Let's give him something else to chew on. There are other NRC commissioners who will be coming up for Senate approval in the coming years. Let's set a precedent now, put some pressure on, and make certain that we get commissioners who will actually stand up for the NRC's slogan, which is protecting people and the environment. Don't hold your breath until they do, but take some actions, and maybe they will. In closing, this has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 17, 2012. You can find us all over the place. We are syndicated now on airprogressive.org, streaming web radio, posted on nuclearhotseat.com. On Facebook, we have two pages, Nuclear Hot Seat and Nuclear Hot Seat Group, and you can subscribe on iTunes Podcasts. If you have a moment and can get to the Facebook site, click like. It will help us show up in the Google algorithm. Also, the first video is up on Nuclear Hot Seat Now channel on YouTube. It's the interview with Kathy Iwane in Japan on the proposed burning of nuclear rubble from Fukushima in Wakayama Prefecture. Get it directly from one of the activists who's been involved. This is Libby Halevi of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we have all had our nuclear wake-up call. Now, do not go back to sleep. Be safe, be well, and I'll speak with you next week.